are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 5th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative reporter Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal and author of Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Meanwhile, it's election day. Some key state houses, governorship up for grabs. Some important this city council race in Seattle, big deal. Couple of ballot measures. Meanwhile, Trump officially pulls out of the Paris Accords. Democrats release more private impeachment depositions and Republicans panic. Lev Parnas, Rudy Giuliani's client, and also coincidentally my Halloween costume, supposedly to cooperate with impeachment proceedings. Julian Castro contracts and Tom Steyer's campaign worker steals. And an ABC anchor is caught on tape revealing that ABC quashed the Epstein story 3 years ago. An immigrant in ICE custody was pulled off as life support over the family objections. This is a cue for the Republican-controlled Senate to hold more hearings like they did with Terry Schiavo. Lastly, new swing state polling is a little bit all over the place, but Biden and Bernie atop Trump consistently, Warren a bit less so. But all of this is predicated on Trump not capturing more revanchists who are indeed out there. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is a Tuesday. It is the Majority Report. Matt is out, but everybody else is here today. We appreciate your tuning in. A reminder, AM Quickie being blasted out every morning. We're endeavoring to get out even earlier, but right now it should be hitting your boxes by 8:30. One or two people email us and said it gets there late, but I think that's just a function of you have to refresh.
Who doesn't like an AM quickie?
There you go. It gives you just a quick headlines for the day. amquickie.com. You can sign up via there or through our app, which is available at majorityapp.com. Follow us on Instagram. MajorityReport.fm on Instagram. We're going to try and start putting it up there, right? At least just the headline. Is that what we're going to do?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think that's a good idea.
Glad we're on top of that. Let's start here. You know, there's nothing sadder than to see someone bullied and to see someone who is struggling every day just to manage their multiple home life or their...
just to put yachts in the marina.
I mean, look, just for a moment, and I know people get a little knee-jerk about this, but just imagine you had, you know, everybody, I think, you know, if you're a homeowner, even if you're a renter and you have family, you've got a lot of organizing stuff. Like you got to time out when you're getting toilet paper and paper towels and paying the Con Ed bill or, you know, the electric bill or whatever it is. Just imagine for a moment, before you get all judgy, what if you had 10 homes? What if you had 12 homes? Just think of the incredible sense of anxiety you would have constantly. But you work at it because it's important. It's important for the country. And here's a guy, Leon Cooperman, who refers to himself as a philanthropist. That's his job, apparently. Philanthropy. Now, he still makes a ton of money, of course, because he's a billionaire and he's heavily invested in a lot of different things. But he's a philanthropist. That's what that's what it's all about for him now.
I had no idea philanthropy was so lucrative.
Well, I'm also a philanthropist because I've given money to charity. And so apparently you can just adopt that. But he's a philanthropist. Now, I don't know what he's doing on CNBC. Why isn't he on the philanthropy network? Why is he on a business channel? That's
wherever
weird.
He is the philanthropy network. He's so committed.
Leon Cooperman.
I don't need Elizabeth Warren or the government giving away my money. Just tell me what you think the maximum tax rate should be. Stop talking about 2% where you're basically misrepresenting the facts. It's 2% of wealth. Just think about this. If Jeff Bezos' wealth is tied up all in Amazon stock, he's going to be forced every year to sell 2% of his stock, regardless of what the outlook is for the company. That's just wrong. It's wrong. It's going to lead to inappropriate actions in the economy that are counterproductive. Everyone I know that struck it big, I've written in my letter about Bernie Marcus. He and Ken Langone have given back billions to society, and they employ 400,000 people, and 3,000 of the employees are millionaires. You know, 25 years ago, I was honored by a charity. And at my request, Congressman Jack Kemp, who's deceased, spoke at the dinner. And he said, in America, people don't hate the wealthy. They want to be them. And Warren and Sanders are basically trying to make boogeymen out of wealthy people. And it's counterproductive. It's wrong. I am not in favor.
Pause it for 1 second. I just want to stop at one thing that he had said. You know, he's making a point that these millionaires and billionaires, or billionaires he's really talking about, he doesn't really hang out with millionaires.
They're not philanthropists.
They give back billions of dollars to the country. And he's saying, he's arguing, and I think the quote may be coming up, all of Sanders and Warren are doing, they're just playing to the masses. Well, I got news for you. Guess what the masses have done, too? They've given even more billions back to the country. The masses spend all of their money. In fact, the masses give almost 100% of their money to the country. 100% they give it to the country in the same way these billionaires have given billions to the country. Just I just thought we would just make that clear.
Impeachment inquiry. I want the American people to decide in November of 2020 what the future should be.
I think it's kind of obvious. People can not only see the emotion on your face, but hear it in your voice when you talk about this, Lee. Why?
I care. That's it.
Oh, man.
I mean, look, sometimes you go into CNBC, you're feeling a little emotional, and, you know, maybe things that are happening at home get wrapped up in your concerns about people villainizing Ken Langone, who incidentally wanted to privatize our public college education. Oh, speaking of our public school thing. Oh, speaking of college and public and this and that, this guy cares so much that back in 2015. He decided that he was going to stick up for a little company called Navient that was...
Take your time.
Breathe
his
in.
His hedge
you
fund
you...
had invested a lot of money in Navient. And there's a HuffPo story, I think, from 2015. And they were fighting to avoid a lawsuit from those people at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for allegedly cheating borrowers. And the federal regulators had told the company that year that investigators had found evidence indicating that Navient had violated consumer protection laws. And he cared so much that he said the government was beating up on Navient for no good reason. That all these,
he doesn't like bullies.
He doesn't like bullies. And in fact, he apparently on an investor call asked specifically how Elizabeth Warren might impact their earnings.
Because he cares.
Because he cares.
I mean, look, the more she takes out of Navient, the more you destroy philanthropy, bro. Maybe you should get out of your head and out of your snark and think about it a little bit.
All he wants is the ability to help this country in a way that he deems fit. Not the government, dirty government bureaucrats protecting so-called student loaners, borrowers.
You know, I take some money from some shiftless kid who could easily walk to work or skip a few meals. And then I take that and I bring it to the ballet. And I don't see what's wrong with that.
I'm sorry.
I just don't believe in bullies. I mean, this really is like Hitler's Germany or any other insane historical offensive analogy.
Back on government regulators trying to protect people who are deeply in debt because of fraudulent and inappropriate collection agency practices is wrong, then guilty. But not so much that I could go to jail or get fined.
With so. Each call to each of those shiftless, lazy bums was a dollar that I was able to get a building named after me with.
I saw Kent Langone after one of these diatribes by the Sanders Warren people. He had indigestion.
You never seen Ken. I haven't seen Ken this upset since they tried to unionize a Home Depot back in Montauk.
And they had to sometimes.
Those people
all because of Chinese plywood that was off-gassing poisonous material.
Oh, it's Ken's fault that people are dying when they touch Home Depot plywood. This is socialism. And I got scared. All I just want to say, we haven't gotten any of that money back yet. So it's fun, but we haven't onward to victory. And two, imagine the crying when we actually do get some of that money back.
Oh my God. If I could drink a cup of that guy's tears, I feel like I would live forever.
Hashtag goals. I was saying off air, like there are way more similarities between Russia and the United States than standard narrative would concede. But where are the Russian oligarchs? They have balls. I built $1 billion out of a criminal VCR business. Now I'm on the board of Gazprom. Oh, you don't like that? How about I kill you and your family in the middle of the night? They're not on like, I just want to help everyone so much. You know, like I sell a Sony VCR during Perestroika. It hurt my feelings.
Warren would be great in a regulatory role, just regulating the heck out of these guys.
Folks, it's that time of season, or that time of season? That time of year. It's that season. You know, the time of year where people get sick around this office. As much as I say, get a flu shot, I will even subsidize it.
How generous.
Well,
I mean, what are you looking over here for?
I'm not, am I looking over there? But what happens? We get sick, got to drink a lot of water, get dehydrated. Well, around this office anyways, we have one way of doing it. Liquid IV. It hydrates you 2 to 3 times faster and more efficiently than water alone, with the added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, B12. Whenever I go to Vegas, when I tend to drink a little too much, or when I'm flying, which I do both of those things when I go to Vegas, I take a bunch of packets of Liquid IV, my favorite, lemon lime, but I will drink, I'll also do the acai berry. It's tremendous. I don't drink enough water. This allows me to basically drink 2 to 3 times more water than I'm drinking at any given point. Liquid IV, it's the fastest growing wellness brand. All their products, non-GMO, vegan, free of gluten, free of dairy, free of soy. And you can find Liquid IV everywhere, even at Costco. It's a great healthy alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks. Perfect for fueling tough workouts, preventing muscle fatigue, and promoting a healthy post-workout recovery. Of course, I never pitch that because I don't do enough exercise.
We need more. We need to re-up.
I know. Actually, I think I have one in my bag.
It actually, I will say, all kidding aside, because I'm back at it, it does help.
Stuff works.
You got to sign it out.
It really does. Endorsed by, I was at a wedding, endorsed by a dancer in the Martha Graham Dance Company.
Is that right? Mine.
Yeah, she had a bunch of them. She's like, you guys want these? I was like, we have them at the studio. They're great.
Liquid IV.
No, we don't. We should have took them, man.
It's available in convenient TSA-friendly powder packs for travel, perfect for combating jet lag and altitude sickness. I love Liquid IV. I know you will, too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 25% off of anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY, 25% off. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today, ladies and gentlemen. Also, we talked about this at the beginning of school. I know this because I have a teenager, but also... different folks have this problem on occasion. Always seems like on the days you have something important, a pimple shows up. Now with Proactive MD, you have the solution. With America's number one acne brand, Proactive has helped fight acne for almost 25 years. Now they've introduced their next generation acne treatment system. It's called Proactive MD. It contains a dermatologist-recommended topical retinoid called Adapalene. That's what it's called. I still consider him my father-in-law, but really sort of technically my ex-father-in-law is a dermatologist. He's been telling me about this stuff for quite some time. It's the newest acne-fighting innovation. It's made available to over-the-counter consumers. First one in over 30 years. Kelly's been using Proactive for ages. Old Kelly, not old Kelly, but formerly of the show Kelly. She's not totally formerly of the show, but formerly producing the show. She wrote me, said she's been using Proactive on and off since high school. The formula has improved over the years, but the idea remained the same. Proactive is a program of skincare that gives you short and long-term results. It's the best acne-fighting product that doesn't require a prescription. It's been that way for a long time. She writes, I have sensitive skin, and Proactive's program made my skin smoother and clearer without causing redness or peeling. She said it only takes a few weeks to achieve noticeable differences in your skin. And she writes that confidence makes all the difference. Going back to school with noticeably clearer skin leaves one less to worry about. Proactive is so reliable. It fights acne, improves the brightness and overall appearance of my skin. It's the best regimen I've ever used. And right now, our listeners can go to proactive.com/majority and receive an exclusive on-the-go bag. Features Proactive T-Zone Oil Absorber, Body Acne Wipes, and Green Tea Moisturizer. That's close to $100 value. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee as well, folks. So go to Proactive, proactive.com/majority. Proactive.com/majority to order and get clear skin for the win. We will, of course, put all of our links to our ads in our show descriptions, both the YouTube and the podcast. Check it out. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to Aaron Glantz on Homewreckers, how a gang of Wall Street kingpins, hedge fund magnates, crooked banks, vulture capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream, features a couple of people's names that you will know from the current administration. Can you imagine?
Don't say anything about them.
Don't forget, folks, you can support this show by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. We'll be back in a moment.
A mist is hanging gently on the lake. My house is very beautiful at night. My friend and teacher occupies a spare room. He's dead, at peace at last, the wandering Jew. Other friends had put stones on his grave. He was the first great man that I had ever met. Sylvie and I got out our Ouija board to dial the spirit across the room it soared. We were happy and amazed at what we saw. Blazing stood the proud and regal name Delmore. Delmore, I missed all your funny ways. I missed your jokes and the brilliant things you said. My dead list to your bloom was such a perfect wit. And to find you in my house makes things perfect. I've really got a lucky life. My writing, my motorcycle, and my wife. And to top it all off, a spirit of pure poetry is living in this stone and wood house with me. Image of the poets in the breeze. Canadian geese are flying above the trees. A mist is hanging gently on the lake. Our house is very beautiful at night.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program senior reporter at Reveal, author of Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. Aaron Glantz, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so just let's just sort of, your book is set, it's almost like, it's almost a, I guess, a sequel of sorts. Maybe it's a little bit too early to write the sequel, but maybe not in some ways, of what we learned about why there was a financial crisis. You look at the sort of what happened in the wake of the financial crisis, specifically in terms of homeowners. 8 million people lost their homes in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Just give us the overall gist of what you're looking at here.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there has been so much journalism dissecting exactly why the economy collapsed 10 years ago. Right. And, you know, the fact that we bailed out the banks instead of the American public, like, this is well known. Right. But we seem to have forgotten the fact that in the meantime, 10 years have gone by. Right. And we're living in a country right now where the unemployment rate is low. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is high. The president is telling us the economy is fantastic. And yet, across the political spectrum, we know that that doesn't tell the whole story. You know, we live in a country where the top one-tenth of 1% now has as much wealth as the bottom 90%, a wealth gap that we haven't seen in 100 years. And so, since we live in a country where our wealth is tied to our home, where home ownership is the American dream, it seemed like looking at what happened over the past decade would be a very fruitful exercise.
And we should say that home ownership is the primary driver of intergenerational wealth, which is, I mean, to a large extent, and this is a, well, in some respects, it's a similar story, but it's a slightly different story as to, you know, what accounts for the some of the major discrepancies between, let's say, black wealth and white wealth in this country is a function of home policy, of home ownership policies that we've had throughout our history. And in some respects, some of this is not terribly different. There's an element of that. A lot of the people who lost their homes were black people, brown people in this country. So what was the main, in the wake of the financial crisis, we have people who find that they're underwater on their mortgages. They have signed up for mortgages because of really unscrupulous, I mean, crooked, fraudulent, however you want to express this, mortgage providers into loans that they could not, they either didn't understand or simply could not afford, largely because of these sort of ballooning interest rates. I mean, just give us a sense of like what was the predicate for the scams that basically followed.
Well, I guess the easiest way to understand this is actually to look at the home wreckers, because when you start to talk about the financial concepts, it can give you a headache really fast, right? Which is why I try to tell this as a story about families and homes and the capitalists who benefited. And the first capitalist that I talk about in the book is Steve Mnuchin, who is now Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. And what happened was that there was this bank in Southern California called IndyMac. It was the, you know, some of your listeners may remember it. It was the first big failure of the financial crisis before even Lehman Brothers. There was a run on the bank. It was broadcast live on television. There were crowds around the block at its Pasadena, California headquarters. And the government stepped in and took the bank over, right? And most people were looking at this bank and going, what a disaster. It was offering all those predatory financial products that you were just talking about. one of its big products was the Ninja Loan. No income, no job, no assets, no problem. Another big product that it offered was the reverse mortgage, which is exactly what it sounds like. Instead of you paying off the mortgage month after month and your debt going down and you building wealth for your family, the amount of the mortgage goes up every month. And when you die, the bank takes the house. These were the kind of products that IndyMac did. And so Steve Mnuchin, who's now Trump's Treasury Secretary, he was sitting in his office in Manhattan watching this disaster unfold on CNBC, and he saw an opportunity. And he put together this group of investors that included George Soros, John Paulson, Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, and they took this bank off the government's hands. They paid the government nothing for the bank, and then they made an agreement whereby the government subsidized them while they foreclosed on families. So over the following 10 years, the government, according to documents I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, paid Mnuchin and his group over $1 billion as they foreclosed on over 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors.
Okay, and there's a couple of things that we need to tease out here. First off, when Mnuchin organizes this this group of investors, essentially, this hedge fund consortium of sorts to buy IndyMac, turn it into One West, they do so. The reason why they have that many people, you write, or I should say that many partners, is because the way that regulation, that bank regulation would kick in is if any one of those hedge funds owned enough of the bank that they became, they qualified as being sort of a bank holding company. But by each chipping in a small enough amount, then the regulation doesn't kick in the same way. Is that right?
Right. So, you know, there's all kinds of requirements for transparency. You know, the Federal Reserve is going to go look at your books if you own a bank, right? Because we don't want the global economy to collapse again. So each of the investors in Mnuchin's group owns under 25% of the bank. And some of them own like ridiculously close to 25%. 24.974% is the percentage owned by J.C. Flowers and Company, for example. So they basically want to put as little money of their own in, get as much taxpayer subsidies as possible, and have as little government scrutiny as possible. And this led to a rigged system over the course of the ensuing decade. So, you know, you started off, 8 million homes were foreclosed on after the financial crisis. First of all, why were so many homes foreclosed on? Because the incentives went in that direction. Second of all, why didn't other families buy these homes, right? Why didn't we just have some families, maybe they took out irresponsible mortgages and they lost, and other families won? Again, you know, the system was rigged in the favor of giant corporate landlords rather than individual families.
Okay, so let's talk about that first part of the incentive structure to foreclose. So this is a sort of a classic case of we're going to allow you to privatize the profits and socialize the costs, but with the added feature of not only do you, you're not only going to socialize the costs. In fact, you were going to pay you to socialize the costs is really the way that this worked, right? So explain that dynamic about why it became more profitable for a One West to actually force people into foreclosure, almost like, you know, sort of like, and this is the thing that I think is really hard for people to grasp. Like, why would it be more profitable for a loan servicer or maybe even the owner of a loan to force the borrower into default, essentially, in this circumstance?
Right. Because normally, if you're a bank, you want the loan to be paid back with interest, right? That's how you make money. And on the other hand, if you foreclose on a family and take the house, especially if it's a financial crisis and the house isn't worth as much as the loan, you would stand to lose a bucket of money, right? That would be like real capitalism. right? But we didn't live, and after the financial crisis, we didn't live in like a real free market situation. We lived in a situation where the government was subsidizing people like Steve Mnuchin to foreclose on people. So the way it worked was, when Steve Mnuchin and his group acquired this bank, they were able to keep all the profits that they made on their new businesses. So, for example, Steve Mnuchin's bank became a huge lender to fracking companies, exploiting oil, you know, out of the ground. It became a big financier of Hollywood films, some of your listeners probably know, right, and other private equity firms. Now, it could keep all the money that it made on this new business. Now, it had also this portfolio of bad loans from IndyMac from the financial crisis. With those loans, if it lost money on those loans by foreclosure, we agreed to pay for up to 90% of their losses. And not only the loss of the loan, we agreed to pay for most of their attorney's fees, appraisal costs, inspection costs, all the things that the bank usually doesn't want to do in a foreclosure. We agreed to pick up that tab.
Now, to be clear, they didn't pay for the loans in the first place, right?
I actually got an email from Steve Mnuchin after this book came out. He was upset at the way I'm characterizing this. So since we have some time, let me slow down.
Please.
They paid the government nothing, right? They then did invest $1.6 billion in the actual bank, which they capitalized and then went off and did all the other businesses that I've been talking about, like financing fracking, for example, right? But they didn't pay anything to the government for all of these bad loans. No, they basically the deal that the government was like, we're going to lose even more money if we get stuck with all this ourselves. Here, you take it and we'll pick up a lot of the losses. Right. But so what they did was, it's like we gave them this like junk car. Right. Then they invested a couple thousand dollars in fixing up the junk car. Eventually, they sell the bank. Steve Mnuchin actually sells this bank to his upstairs neighbor in a Park Avenue apartment house. He's able to keep all that money and never pay back any of the losses that we paid to him and his group.
So let me try and refine this analogy, and you tell me if this is right. What they actually did is they bought a car repair garage, and there's a dozen junky cars in there that the government doesn't want to take responsibility for. They used the garage to start offering all sorts of other stuff, like we're going to do detailing, we're going to fix your catalytic converters. And they take those junk cars in there, and the government agrees, like, oh, if you dispose of these, we will pay you to dispose of them. And so all they did is they basically threw these out. But in the process of throwing them out, that is the equivalent of basically forcing people into foreclosure, and the government pays them for resolving these loans, right? So did the government anticipate, like, initially, like, oh, they're going to work these loans out and we will just backstop them to give so that the American spirit of going in there and helping homeowners can be encouraged, and we can tell them, like, if you mess up, don't worry, we'll be your safety net. But basically what they said is, we're just going to go directly into the safety net, thanks.
Well, I mean, there were these things called mortgage modification programs. Right. But I mean, anyone who was alive during that time knows how hard they were to access.
This
right?
is HAMP, essentially, right? HAMP.
Yeah.
And
I mean, this even was not HAMP. This even predated HAMP. And it was a special deal that Steve Mnuchin made with the FDIC. And by the way, we haven't talked about Wilbur Ross. Everything that I'm saying about Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross did all the same stuff with a bank in Florida called Bank United that he bought. So that's, you know, that's why the book is The Home Wreckers, because there's this whole crew of these people. So, you know, Mnuchin and Ross both did this. But staying on Mnuchin for a moment, he made this deal with the FDIC. The deal that he made with the FDIC said that we will compensate you for your losses, but first you have to work with the families, right? And you know, even interviewing Sheila Bair, the former chairman of the FDIC, 10 years later, she was still defending this deal to me, like even now, even knowing that 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors, lost their homes and we paid $1 billion to subsidize it. And her reasoning was that if we hadn't done this, our losses would have been even greater.
And the bottom line is that what people accuse Steve Mnuchin and One West of doing is instead of trying to work with the families, they basically worked to get the families to foreclose because it was just basically more profitable for them. And that is what they started to investigate at the California State Attorney General's office, right? And will you just tell that part of the story? Because it involves Kamala Harris. I think people have heard it slightly, but not in the level of detail, I think, that you know it.
Right. So, you know, the national settlement with the big banks was going on, right? And Kamala Harris, who was at that time the Attorney General of California, formed a mortgage fraud strike force that was supposed to go after the bad actors. And so her mortgage fraud strike force started to investigate this bank because, as I said, they could get all of this money from the government while foreclosing on people, but only if they worked with families. And what her investigators found, Kamala Harris's investigators found, was systemic abuse and endemic robo-signing. So I always thought robo-signing was like a robot signing paperwork. Actually, what it meant was that there were human beings sitting in a warehouse in Texas that were signing these papers so fast that it was as if they were robots. And in the process, a lot of people were getting foreclosure notices who never should have been foreclosed on. You know, there was this woman in Florida, the most famous case, who got a foreclosure notice over a 27-cent payment error. 90-year-old woman, right? These should not have happened, but they happened because there was like this conveyor belt of foreclosure and cashing in. So investigators for Kamala Harris, who were in her mortgage fraud strike force that she talked about, you know, at the Democratic National Convention in a prime speaking spot in 2012, they pointed the finger at One West and they told her to sue this bank, and she buried it.
Do we know why she buried it?
The explanation that she's given is a legalistic one that says that as the state attorney general, she could have not gone after a national bank like One West. But her own staff firmly disagreed with this. And they also made another point, which I think is really important, which is they said even if they sued One West and lost, that there would have been substantial public interest in simply documenting for the public what this bank was doing, right? Even if they couldn't get a legal settlement. I mean, instead of that, I mean, this, the only reason we know this is that when Steve Mnuchin was up for attorney general, this document, this report by her staff that I'm talking about was leaked to a journalist of The Intercept.
Yep. Dan, we, you know, on many times.
Yep. So here I am, right, in 2019, writing about a document that she buried in 2013, right? So wouldn't it have been nice, her attorneys argue, that even if we end up losing the case, to have all this great information having the light of day, you know, for many years beforehand, we might have stopped the flow of all these, you know, at that point we'd only spend like $300 million subsidizing this bank. We'd go on to spend hundreds of millions more.
And just to be clear, the other thing that the government could have done, and there's some question as to whether, you know, and this is, you know, obviously what happened with One West happened, or I should say, what happened with IndyMac happened, you know, prior to the actual crisis in September of 08. But there was an opportunity to just give this money directly, to have the government actually do the workouts of these loans rather than rely on the good graces of people who are incentivized to do the opposite, to do them. And had the government done the workout of these loans, basically just coming in and saying, we're going to cut your principal, the banks could have been saved that way, right?
Well, there were going to have to be losses, right? I mean, there's no doubt about it, right? Like, it was a disaster. But we decided to assess all of those losses on working families. And that's why the homeownership rate went down every single year during the Obama presidency until it bottomed out in 2016 at a 50-year low. Right? We saved the banks, not the people. In the Great Depression, President Roosevelt did exactly what you were talking about, which is that we created a government-run bank. The bank refinanced one out of every five loans in urban America. It saved a million homes. And it propelled equitable growth in this country for generations. After World War II was over, we had the GI Bill. The GI Bill was another government-run lending program, helped 4 million American veterans buy homes. Important fact about both of these programs, the Homeowners Loan Corporation made money. The GI Bill broke even because when you invest in the American family and you give them a loan and you charge them interest, most of the time they pay it back, right? So this argument was being made in positions of power in 2008, and not just by lefties. Former members of the Federal Reserve Board were making this argument. Officials with the conservative American Enterprise Institute were making this argument as a fiscally conservative argument, saying, look, you're looking at shoveling all this money at the bankers. When we bailed out the American family, we turned a profit, right? And they were basically laughed out of the room by, you know, both Republicans, but also by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi.
Right. All right. Let's just tell us a little bit about the story of Sandy Jolly. You follow her throughout the story. And in her case, it has, I guess, a happy ending, but it takes a long time to get there. And it's a fairly unique one. But tell us about her.
Yeah, I ran into Sandy about 2 years ago, and she, you know, her dad worked for the water department. Her mom worked for a company that printed payroll checks. He was a World War II veteran, and they had bought, back in the 1980s, this house in Thousand Oaks, California, just north of Los Angeles, for slightly under $90,000. And they had a mortgage payment that was $600 a month. And as they were getting older, and they were in their 70s, sitting at home watching TV, this ad comes on television. James Garner, the actor, is the pitch man for this reverse mortgage. And the company behind the reverse mortgage was IndyMac. After they signed the reverse mortgage, Sandy immediately, their daughter immediately tries to get out of it, and they just won't let her. And she takes them to court, and in 2012, they get foreclosed on by Steve Mnuchin's bank in one of these foreclosures that we've been talking about. But you know, I keep following her and the house even after the foreclosure, because I feel like at the point of the foreclosure, that's when the media usually like checks out, right? But Sandy goes to the auction. She tries to save the house at the auction. And at the auction, the house is bought by this woman who comes with a Bluetooth headset and a little foldable desk. And Sandy doesn't know who she is, but the next day she gets home and she finds out that her house has been sold to a shell company called Colfin AI California 5 LLC. So this house that has been owned by her family for 30 years, now owned by the shell company, and the shell company turns out to be controlled by another one of Donald Trump's friends, Tom Barrack, who is, you know, he introduced Ivanka at the Republican National Convention, and he planned the president's inauguration, and prior to all of that, he was a vulture capitalist amassing a national portfolio of 30,000 homes during the Great Recession. So before, it was 30,000 homes, 30,000 families, now one home, 30,000, one owner, 30,000 homes, right?
Yep.
And Sandy just keeps fighting. She keeps fighting even after that, even after Tom Barrack raises her rent three times, she keeps fighting. And she ends up winning an $89 million whistleblower settlement against Steve Mnuchin's bank.
And this is a whistleblower because it showed this systemic program to get to create foreclosures, essentially.
Yes. Basically, what she alleged was that the Mnuchin's group was illegally billing the government on foreclosures. Mm-hmm. It gets really super complicated. And of course, it was settled without any admission of guilt by Mnuchin's group. Right. So, quote unquote, nobody ever did anything wrong. But, you know, they do end up ponying up $89 million to the federal government. And Sandy gets a $1.6 million, like, finder's fee, basically, for bringing this to the government's attention.
This is a key TAM case where you can actually get a bounty for turning in people who are defrauding the government. And the fraud was a function of they did not essentially do what they were obligated to do in terms of helping homeowners in this instance. But part of the problem was the system was set up to trust people whose job it is in their minds to exploit any asymmetrical understanding of what's going on, essentially.
Right. And like, also think about all the people who screwed up here, right? I mean, the FDIC was supposed to be minding this store. HUD was supposed to be minding this store. The Justice Department was supposed to be minding this store. Kamala Harris was supposed to be minding this store, right? It falls to this woman in Southern California who's just fighting for her own house. Right. And in the course of fighting for her own house, lots of other families start to call her and they're having the same experience she does. So then she finds a Washington, D.C. attorney. He brings her to go meet with the FBI and the Justice Department, all these things. And then finally, you know, in 2017, so almost a decade after all of this starts, the government agrees to this $89 million settlement with the bank. But of course, by this point, Steve Mnuchin has already sold the bank and is the Treasury Secretary.
Right. So, Aaron, where do we go with this understanding of just how people exploited the sort of the mop up, I guess, of the financial crisis or the wake of it? What should we know? What's important for us, I guess, to know going forward? Or how does this inform us for the future?
You know, I think that, first of all, we have to understand where we're at, right? Right now, we're in an era where we're always talking about issues like gentrification, displacement, right? Housing affordability. You know, we live in a country right now where so many families just feel like they're holding on. And we have to put this in the context of a historically low home ownership rate, right? That if you own your home, then you have stability and you can build wealth. So we have to put home ownership like back into the equation and really talk about what happened to these 8 million homes and not just pretend that we have a supply problem. Right. And then second of all, we need to remember the decisions that were made that got us to this point and remember that there were good proposals for a government run bank to bail out the people that, you know, would have rekindled decisions that were made, you know, 80 years before that were helpful to the country and profitable to the government. Right. That led to generations of shared prosperity. And these are really good discussions for us to be having right now when we're in a presidential election season and when a recession could be around the corner. And so, you know, people say like, Aaron, like, why are you writing about this now? It's all old news. I was like, this is exactly what we need to be talking about right now.
Indeed. Homewreckers, how a gang of Wall Street kingpins, hedge fund magnates, crooked banks, and vulture capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolish the American dream. Aaron Glantz, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Just a reminder, this program exists because of your support. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, not only do we give you the free part of the show without commercials, but we also give you extra content every single day. And on top of which, you support the free show. You can search your member programs in the app now, Majority app, with ease. You can download them. Keep them on your phone for when you're in the subway or in the mines or wherever you are, that if you're in a place where there's no reception, you're going hiking or camping somewhere, or maybe you're taking a trip out to the sea. I don't know. Just coming up with different reasons why you would download it, but you can always just stream it, the podcast. You have both options on the app. But either way, become a member of the program today. Join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget, sign up for the AM Quickie. You can do so at amquickie.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday, November 5th, which means that it's a Tuesday. Michael, what happens today?
Big day today. Something very big just happened. At 6 o'clock, pre-stream with Kim Ives, editor of Haiti Liberté. We're going to get into the details of what's happening in Haiti right now, which fits a global pattern, but of course has a unique story. Then for the main show, the peerless Adolph Reed Jr. and Abby Martin makes her debut on the show to talk about her really amazing documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, and the Israeli atrocities in Gaza and elsewhere. And just so that all starts at 6 o'clock at the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. And just really quick, this Friday, Yaleys for Bernie, me and Kyle Kalinske are doing a thing there in New Haven.
Oh, it's really the least those Yaleys could do.
Yeah, I mean, Harvard should step up, incidentally. November 22nd, I'm moderating a panel with Crystal Ball and Matt Karp called Who's Afraid of Bernie for Jacobin. And November 23rd, Philadelphia, get your tickets to World Cafe for the TMBS live show. Patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have some red meat for all you vulgar workerists out there. Let me switch the camera. Sean has done an episode with Billy O'Connor and John Tormey, two of his fellow tradesmen, on the conservatism of business unionism, the mythology surrounding the white working class, and how to turn everyday hatred of the boss into radical class consciousness. And that is out tomorrow for everyone. Also, History is a Weapon. They just dropped a 2-part scorcher on suburbia. It actually kind of hooks into a lot of the things you were talking about in this interview that we just did. The rise of suburbia, the invention of the middle class as a way to conceal class conflict and kind of put a damper on it. Planned post-war communities. They go into the history of Los Angeles, and they're so smart. It's annoying. Just check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Oh, and you know what? I also want to brag for a minute because my fundraiser went real well. And we raised over $700 for El Comedor and Contraviento y Marea, which is, thank you. This mutual aid center in Tijuana, run by migrants and for migrants, along totally autonomous principles. They're not controlled by any state or any NGO. And we're going to raise even more money for them. So I'll put a link in the blog post today.
Salem Witch Trials. Talked about Salem Witch Trials. You're going to like it.
That
check
is
out Literary Hangover on Patreon. Also on YouTube. Thanks.
There you go. Literary Hangover. Check it out. Quick break into the fun half, 646-257-3920. We will get the calls going today, ladies and gentlemen. See you there. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.